from the heart of our nation's capital, here's Family Research Council President Tony Perkins. Sitting in today for Tony is our own Sarah Perry, Director of Partnerships for Family Research Council.
Welcome to Washington Watch. It's Thursday, the 20th of February, and I'm your host, Sarah Perry, Director of Partnerships, sitting in for Tony Perkins this afternoon. While it looked more like an episode of WrestleMania and less like a presidential debate last night, as six Democratic contenders took the floor in Las Vegas to square off against one another in the ninth debate of its kind. There were personal attacks and memes galore, but one thing all the candidates held in common was a commitment to extremism. Who emerged victorious, and how far left has the Democratic Party moved? Well, I'll have Terry Jeffrey, editor-in-chief of CNS News, to share his thoughts. In my second segment, the 11th Circuit took its lead from the Supreme Court recently by ruling that just like the Bladensburg Cross of Maryland, a 78-year-old memorial cross in Pensacola, Florida, does not violate the U.S. Constitution and will remain. This despite the efforts of the often offended American Humanist Association, the very same organization that complained in the case of the Bladensburg Cross. I'll be joined by Katherine Johnson, FRC's Research Fellow for Legal and Policy Studies, who will help me break down the 11th Circuit ruling. At the bottom of the hour, President Trump was in Las Vegas today on the heels of the combative Democratic debate and 2 days before Nevada's presidential caucus. He joined the organization Hope for Prisoners to deliver remarks at their prisoner graduation ceremony. The president has made great strides in the area of criminal justice, including with his First Step Act. That includes a removal of much harsher, earlier sentencing guidelines. I'll have Brooke Rollins, assistant to the president for strategic initiatives, with me to break down some of the accomplishments dedicated to giving former inmates new opportunities and new hope. And in my last segment, the pro-life movement continues to surge with the assistance of a pro-life president and multiple state laws designed to increase protections for the unborn. And the U.S. Senate will vote next week on the Born Alive and Pain Capable bills. FRC is, of course, tracking these and other legislative developments and has provided resources to our listeners that will help you stay active and informed. I'll be joined by Travis Weber, FRC's Vice President for Policy and Government Affairs, and Connor Semmelsberger, FRC's Legislative Assistant, who will both give us an overview of bills on the horizon. As a reminder to those of you listening, TonyPerkins.com is our podcast webpage. You can also find us on all of your regular podcast platforms, Stitcher, Apple, SoundCloud, you name it, you will find us there. Also, a reminder to you listeners, show your support for the life of all babies born alive by sending a baby hat to Congress. We are closing in on the vote in the Senate. Go to endbirthdayabortion.com for more information. Well, in the ninth Democratic debate, the candidates continued to battle for voter support last night in Las Vegas en route to the Democratic nomination. Unfortunately, it was more contentious than a standard political forum, but it did make for some entertaining television. Former New York Mayor Michael Bloomberg caught a lot of the heat on the presidential debate stage, but he also wasn't afraid to dish it either, especially to frontrunner Bernie Sanders. In fact, he made comments on precisely how wealthy this, quote, socialist, end quote, candidate was. Let's listen to what he had to say.
What a wonderful country we have. The best known socialist in the country happens to be a millionaire with three houses. What I miss here.
Now, he continued his pointed critique of Sanders' views and had something to say about exactly how wrong his political philosophies were. Let's listen to this clip.
I can't think of a ways that would make it easier for Donald Trump to get reelected than listening to this conversation. It's ridiculous. We're not going to throw out capitalism. We tried that. Other countries tried that. It was called communism, and it just didn't work.
You can hear the audience oohing and aahing and practically straining to hold back their offense in this situation. But sometimes, unfortunately, the truth hurts. Well, joining me now to talk about the fiery debate is political analyst and editor-in-chief of CNSNews.com, Terry Jeffrey. Terry, welcome back to Washington Watch.
Hey, Sarah. Thanks for having me on.
So I think last night was highly entertaining, although I have to tell you, as far as substantive policy was concerned and political proposals, I didn't see much of anything. So what did you see in last night's Democratic debate?
Well, I agree. I think it was entertaining. I enjoyed watching it. But unfortunately, I think when they have these debates in the liberal media, places like MSNBC, they never ask tough policy questions of the candidate, right. The Democratic candidates. They don't want to force out what these guys actually stand for. I think if Americans really knew what Bernie Sanders stands for, and they will know if he becomes a Democratic nominee, that he'd have absolutely no chance of getting elected. And I think that's exactly the point that Michael Bloomberg was trying to make last night. And I think you're going to see a little bit more. To put this in perspective, on Saturday we have the Nevada caucus. It's the third contest in the Democratic nominating process. According to the latest poll out of Nevada, Sanders is up by 19 points mm-hmm. over Elizabeth Warren, who's running second. He has 35%. She has 16. Buttigieg has 15. Biden has 14. If Bernie Sanders wins 19% in the Nevada caucus, I mean, if he wins by that kind of margin, or even anything approaching that kind of margin in Nevada, it's going to be very difficult for Joe Biden to hold on a week later in South Carolina. If Biden can't hold on in South Carolina, he's a goner. And then it's going to be very difficult for the Democrats to stop Sanders. So I think what we're going to see in the coming days are escalating attacks on Bernie Sanders by people running against him in the Democratic primary, trying right. to point out how radical left he is, even though they are not that much to the right of him.
Well, so it's so interesting you brought that up, because I find myself really sort of locking into the fact that Bloomberg was the only one to say, listen, you can't run as a Democratic socialist in the United States. It's called communism. And I have heard it said that communism is where old socialism goes to die. I think Bernie registers very well with the millennials and the current younger generation. The Bernie bros, obviously, we understand that he polls very well with them. Those are the individuals about which I'm most concerned, because knowing how well Sanders is doing in the poll and the fact that only he and Bloomberg are the only two candidates with sufficient resources and the right set of primaries to advance without having to really make any kind of magic on the debate stage, he's the one I think will say the most about where America is as a nation. And I think for that reason, it really sort of unsettles me that we think, again, in air quotes, speaking for the Democratic voters of America, that the answer to anti-Trumpism is socialism. And I guess if you're talking that, it's accurate, but it's still very unsettling.
You know, to put it in perspective, I've spent a little time reading through some old newspapers from Vermont in 1972. And in 1972, Bernie Sanders, he first ran for the Senate from Vermont in a special election, and then he ran as a third-party candidate. His party is called the Liberty Union Party. He then ran for governor of Vermont. And I will say one thing about Bernie Sanders. When I'm reading those old newspaper stories, I find out he was for all the same things back then that he's for now. He was for socialized medicine. He was for abortion on demand. And in 1972 in Vermont, they were debating whether or not, this was before Roe v. Wade, they were debating whether or not to liberalize the abortion laws and legalize abortion up to 20 weeks. Bernie Sanders was demanding abortion on demand in Vermont, complete unrestricted abortion in 1972, when the Democrats in Vermont in 1972 were not for that. And so what happened in 1972? Not only did Bernie not get elected to the Senate, obviously, from Vermont in 1972, but his Liberty Union candidacy for governor of Vermont went nowhere. But now, all these years later, running on the same agenda he was advocating in 1972, when it was plainly recognized as a socialist agenda even then,
right.
Now he's leading in the race for the Democratic presidential nomination. I think that does tell us about how our country has changed in the years since 1972.
Well, and it's interesting to me that he also was the candidate that, according to MSNBC, who tracked the time spent talking by all the candidates, he was the one who kept talking the most. So this is someone, you know, despite his gruff appearance and his pointed fingers and his hunched back, is really an individual who resonates with these young voters who are driven by this sort of socially just mentality, who believe that all of the rights that they have as Americans are on the line if Donald Trump is reelected. So here we've got Bloomberg and Sanders with the most personal resources. There's a comment from Bloomberg about the fact that the socialist has three houses and that he's technically a communist, which, you know, isn't really far from the truth. So we're clearly understanding Bloomberg was not a winner. I mean, he took some scathing critiques from every other Democratic contender. But I think that of all the comments was probably, as far as I'm concerned, political affiliations notwithstanding, the best thing that came out of the debate is that the Democrat candidate was willing to look at Sanders and say, can we just say what you're really running on? Not that there's a big difference in terms of levels of extremism, but do you think of the entire panoply who we saw last night, are any of these candidates suitable to go toe-to-toe with Donald Trump and actually win?
No, I don't think so, actually. You know, I think there are two things that two indicators that look very good for President Donald Trump right now. One is the economy is doing well. I mean, the economy is growing at an incredible pace, but the economy is growing. We are now in the longest growth cycle in the history of the United States. Employment has remained under 4% for a whole year, which is a remarkable thing. So when the economy is doing well and has done well through Trump's entire presidency, that's a very good thing for the president. Incumbent presidents tend to win when the economy is growing in the election year. And another thing is, when you have a candidate who is very radical and particularly radical on issues that affect swing voters in the key swing states, it's very difficult for the Democrats to win. And let me be more specific. Now, Donald Trump won Pennsylvania. That's a very difficult state for Republican presidential candidates to win. Ronald Reagan won it. George W. Bush didn't, but Ronald Reagan won it. But Trump also won Ohio, which has historically been the swing state in American presidential elections. He also won Michigan. He also won Wisconsin. And what is it that about Trump's message that allowed him to win those swing states that have proved so difficult for a lot of Republicans in recent times? I would say one is he was pro-life. If he wasn't pro-life, he wouldn't have gotten the Republican nomination. He wouldn't have won those states. Number two was his position on illegal immigration. He said he was going to secure the border and enforce the immigration laws. I'd also say that his position on trade and his foreign policy perspective also helped him with the swing voters in those states. Now, Bernie Sanders, if he's a Democratic nominee, he's going to say things about trade and foreign policy that are actually going to sound, ironically, somewhat similar to Trump and would appeal to that vote. However, Bernie Sanders is 100% pro-abortion, and he's 100% for open borders, even to the extent that he's going to give his Medicare for all to illegal aliens. And I think Donald Trump will just destroy Bernie Sanders on those issues in states like Pennsylvania, Michigan, Wisconsin.
Terry Jeffrey of CNSNews.com. Always fun talking politics with you, my friend. Coming up next, a World War II-era Bayview Cross. This one in Pensacola, Florida, gets to stay after a recent 11th Circuit ruling. We'll be back to discuss it with Katherine Johnson of FRC next.
In the U.S., the rate of chemical abortions is at an all-time high. This increase is being driven by the abortion industry, which wants abortion pills available through the pharmacy in the mail, making do-it-yourself abortions the future of the abortion industry. Abortion advocates once claimed that legal abortion would prevent back-alley abortions, but the health complications that often result from chemical abortion are eerily similar to those of back-alley abortions. For more information, visit frc.org/chemicalabortion.
China has become one of the most totalitarian states in human history. The Chinese Communist Party restricts religious practice and oppresses religious minorities on a sweeping scale, targeting those of every faith. The Chinese Communist Party's consistent abuses of human rights prove that it cannot be treated just like any other country. The United States must address these violations in their trade and diplomatic dealings with China. For more information about the human rights crisis in China, visit frc.org/China.
What are you reading this winter? Looking for timely and original commentary on human dignity, marriage, and religious liberty? We've got you covered at frcblog.com. The content on our blog is written by our policy experts, FRC staff, as well as outside contributors. Read about a wide variety of topics like crimes in the criminal state of China, how Game of Thrones mainstreamed sexual exploitation, transgender regret, the rise of the detransitioners, and many more. Stand for truth by staying informed at frcblog.com.
What other trip to Israel can you take that combines walking where Jesus walked with meeting today's Israeli leaders? This is Tony Perkins, president of Family Research Council, inviting you to spend an incredible 9 days in Israel with me, General Jerry Boykin, and former Congresswoman Michelle Bachmann from June the 2nd through the 12th. You'll discover the roots of your faith and learn from experts about the geopolitical landscape of the region. For more information, visit TonyPerkins.com or call 844-872-5155.
We all need to be lectured sometimes. Family Research Council's new podcast features selected talks by top thinkers from the archives of the FRC Speaker Series. Our podcast podium takes on tough issues like religious liberty, life, marriage, family, sexuality, public policy, and the culture, all from a biblical worldview. Listen with us to the lecture, then stick around afterward as we break down the content. The Lecture Me podcast is available wherever podcasts are found, or visit frc.org/podcasts.
Ever heard the term toxic masculinity? Hello, this is Tony Perkins, president of the Family Research Council. Some progressive universities are offering courses to help men unlearn rigid definitions of masculinity, treating it as if it were a mental health condition. Thankfully, the culture doesn't have the last word on manhood. God does. Check out our StandCourageous.com for an event in your area. That's StandCourageous.com.
Welcome back to Washington Watch. I'm Sarah Perry, sitting in for Tony Perkins. TonyPerkins.com is our podcast website. Follow Tony on Twitter at T Perkins or me at Sarah P. Perry. Well, if it sounds like Bladensburg 2.0, the American Humanist Association, the American Legion, on appeal to the Supreme Court, it was determined that, according to the justices, that the cross could stand. It was appropriate historically. They scrapped the long-held lemon test, convoluted for many years and critiqued for many years, in light of historical and long-standing symbols. So the two cases bear quite a bit of similarity. The 11th Circuit Court of Appeals has just ruled that a World War II-era Bayview cross in Pensacola, Florida, does not violate the U.S. Constitution and also can remain standing. It's a big win for religious freedom. And joining me now to talk about it is FRC's Research Fellow for Legal and Policy Studies, Catherine Johnson. Catherine, welcome to Washington Watch.
Thanks for having me, Sarah. Happy to be here.
So let's talk a little bit about this decision procedurally, right? So the American Humanist Association brings its original suit in 2016, also the original complainant in Bladensburg, Maryland, with their World War II-era cross. And one would think that in light of what the Supreme Court decided in June 2019 with the Bladensburg cross, the American Humanist Association would ultimately decide that they have perhaps fought too long over religious-infused but not religious-establishing symbols. So tell me a little bit about how the two cases are related.
Yeah, that's right. So both involve a cross on public land. And the Supreme Court, actually, this 11th Circuit case, they appealed it to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court sent it back and said, in light of the American Legion, the Bladensburg cross case, we want this to be reconsidered. So it's both a group of people who claim to be deeply offended by the sight of a cross on public land, wanting that cross to be removed.
So what is the significance of the 11th Circuit decision, and what does this mean going forward, hopefully, for other historical symbols that have a religious appearance?
It's another big win for religious liberty. I mean, certainly these crosses, these symbols of religion in our country symbolize something, and they show the role that religion plays in the public and in people's lives and communities. Specifically, in times of suffering, the predominant faith of a community really manifests itself. And that's exactly what happened in Pensacola. It was right before World War II in times of a national crisis. The community came together and put up this cross. So it's definitely reassuring to know that these symbols and these signs of faith and strength in a community and everything else is going to be able to stand. And hopefully, you know, we can hope that the people will stop coming after these.
Now, it's interesting, you actually mentioned something that I wanted to touch on, which is the fact that it represents a sacrifice. It has historical significance. It marks a time and a place in human American history. And these are important for not just the fact that they are religious imagery, but really because they were set up as a memorial to individuals who had made the ultimate sacrifice. Steve Scalise, during the period in which members of Congress had submitted an amicus brief on the Bladensburg Cross case to the Supreme Court, actually pointed out that the heart of these religious freedom attacks, people are sort of stymied by, right? So how does a court full of unelected judges say that you can't have a way to recognize the men and women who died for the country, regardless of what the imagery is? This was during World War I for 100 years, just as with this cross, which is a World War II era cross, the American Humanist Association shows up and is suddenly offended, even though prior to this point there have not been any complaints. So what do you think is the reason behind the attacks on these historical symbols? And do you think an organization like American Humanists will continue to attack them, or do you think they'll be sort of staved off by this recent decision?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's very clearly an attack on any sort of symbol of faith. And what was most shocking to me was actually two of the plaintiffs in this 11th Circuit case live in Canada. So it's just, like I said, completely shocking that people live in Canada are going after a cross in Pensacola, Florida. And it's clear that they're just trying to erase any sort of symbolism of Christianity or religion from the public sphere. And that, you know, I just find it shocking that someone living in Canada can be so offended by a cross in Florida.
So the Supreme Court tossed the Lemon Test, the very complicated multi-level inquiry that dates back decades. They scrapped that as concerns these historical symbols. Are you hopeful that the Lemon Test might be eliminated whole cloth, as it seems to be that, at least as far as the conservative justices are concerned, they are trending toward really desiring a reconfiguration and a reexamination of appropriate religious liberty standards in the country?
I'm certainly hopeful that this could be the end of Lemon. I mean, the 11th Circuit interpreted the American Legion case to say, you're right, Lemon is dead in cases involving religious displays and monuments, including crosses. In the American Legion case, Justice Thomas went so far as to say, I would scrap Lemon from all aspects of the Establishment Clause analysis. So it definitely seems to be with the appointment of Justice Kavanaugh and more of a conservative majority that this really could be a new era for religious liberties at the courts, including the end of the Lemon Test.
Well, to do that, we'd unfortunately need another case like this to come before the court, and maybe they will have had an opportunity to re-examine and reconstitute their previous thinking on what ought to be the standard for religious liberty in the country. Katherine Johnson is our research fellow for legal and policy studies. She's been my guest today. Well, coming up, I've got a special guest from the White House. President Trump has just recently, this day, delivered remarks at the Hope for Prisoners graduation ceremony. And he has this as part of an overall criminal justice reform package. We'll talk to Assistant to the President for Strategic Initiatives, Brooke Rollins, about the good news right after this on Washington Watch.
this is Tony Perkins, president of the Family Research Council and host of Washington Watch. I invite you to join our family and thousands of others across the country in standing on the Word of God as we go into 2020, the global year of the Bible, by joining in a two-year family chronological Bible reading plan. I can assure you that your family will be powerfully impacted by reading God's Word and growing in the understanding of His truth together. The readings take only 15 to 20 minutes a day, with Sundays set aside for a family or small group discussion. To join us, simply go to TonyPerkins.com and click on Stand on the Word with FRC. That's TonyPerkins.com or call 800-225-4008. That's 800-225-4008. Let's stand together on the Word of God and change the world, beginning in our own home.
Last year, my brother Josh, a 37-year-old married father with five kids under the age of nine, announced he was becoming a woman. Josh changed his name to Melissa and now requires everyone to use she, her pronouns when referring to him. If the grandparents refuse to do this, they've been threatened with limited access to their grandchildren. My tall, handsome, muscular brother began taking strong female hormones that transformed him into a different person. He began wearing dresses, wigs, heels, and makeup in public. He will have to stay on female hormones until the day he dies. He refuses to answer to the name Josh now. He says Josh is dead. There was even some type of symbolic burial ceremony to say goodbye to Josh, once and for all. You've been listening to an excerpt from a six-part series telling the true account of a family impacted by the transgender movement. To read this important blog series, visit frc.org/cult.
Welcome back to Washington Watch. I'm Sarah Perry, sitting in for Tony Perkins on this Thursday afternoon. Well, President Trump just today, a few hours ago, delivered remarks at the Hope for Prisoners graduation ceremony in Las Vegas, Nevada. Fresh off the heels of that contentious Democratic debate and 2 days before the Democratic caucuses in Las Vegas, he is doing significant things about criminal justice reform and gave hope to a number of prisoners who were on their way to new chances. Joining me now to talk about it is Assistant to the President for Strategic Initiatives, Brooke Rollins. Brooke, welcome to Washington Watch. Brooke, are you there?
Oh, there I am. My apologies to you and your listeners. I'm so happy to be with you, but really coming live to you from the airport in Las Vegas. So I had you on mute. You don't have to hear that background, but so happy to be on. Thank you.
Well, we are so excited about not only the remarks that he delivered at the Prisoners of Hope graduation ceremony, but about this First Step Act, which is really landmark criminal justice reform. Can you tell me a little bit about the act?
Yeah, this president, it's really remarkable, and I've now worked for him for almost 2 years. Before that, worked alongside him back at my think tank in Texas called the Texas Public Policy Foundation. So personally, you know, we were one of the leading groups on this for years and years, but building more prisons and warehousing more people in prisons just didn't make sense. It didn't make sense for the taxpayer, didn't make sense for the community, didn't make sense for the family, didn't make sense for the faith community. So how do we completely redirect the current system? So out in the States, Texas led the way. Lots of years of hard work and lowering crime and closing prisons. And ultimately, this president and this team saw what an incredible opportunity to stand up for the forgotten Americans that this president campaigned on, Forgotten No More. And so to see the First Step Act pass Washington, D.C., and then today, that was a year ago, year and a half ago, and then today to be with these graduating, returning citizens in Las Vegas, Nevada, where the president of the United States gave the commencement address. I'm not sure that's ever happened before, so it was very exciting.
It's incredibly encouraging. I think to those of us who watched the remarks, who've been watching the development of the First Step Act and seeing its initial steps into practice, I think there's some people who hear criminal justice reform and they think law and order will be sacrificed at the expense of creating more opportunity, changing minimum sentencing guidelines. And these were a hallmark, as you know, for years of the Democratic Party. We were sort of pushing law and order, and Bill Clinton made this a hallmark of his campaigning. But this is something he's very passionate about. He has eliminated the mandatory three strikes rule. Talk a little bit about the balance between safety and hope for these released prisoners.
Well, that's right. But, you know, it's interesting because most people think of it as a binary choice, but it's really not. They are married together. And here's why. The data in the states has proven that by putting more money into rehabilitation and addiction services and job training, the community becomes safer. In Texas, over 10 years, we closed 10 adult prisons. Keep in mind, wow, this is at a time our population was exploding. Closed 10 adult prisons because of our jobs, closed 10 adult prisons, closed 13 juvenile facilities. And in that same period of time, crime decreased by over 30%.
Wow.
So when you give people, there's not ever going to be a more law and order president than this one, which is probably why we got it done. You know, he's such a disruptor and he's such a change agent. He's such a transformative leader. He doesn't really care about what the status quo is or was or did. He wants to make things right. So while putting law enforcement first and making sure that our citizens first and foremost are safe, but marrying that with second chances and opportunity and from poverty to prosperity is really what he stands for. It's what his first 3 years have stood for, and it's what hopefully the second term will stand for also.
I love the fact that there is a sort of entire second chance component to this, where it's not just the fact that you're providing empty promises of renewed opportunity, but truly there's additional Pell granting going out through the Department of Education, Department of Justice and bureaus, a new Ready to Work initiative, and then labor awarding $2.2 million to states who are using fidelity bonds to underwrite companies that hire former prisoners. So it's not just a, listen, we're going to change sentencing guidelines. It's, we're going to give you an opportunity once you come out, and we're going to leverage all of the power and resources that we have to encourage the right behavior. So if you want people to know one thing about the First Step Act and what they ought to be aware of as this particular package starts becoming a little more fluid, a little more involved in our everyday lives, what would that be, Brooke?
Well, it's really about creating safer communities and communities where the American dream is possible. It's both. And using the First Step Act in the federal system, which is only 10% of our prison population, most of our inmates are in the state populations, but the Bureau of Prisons, the federal government, this president, this White House, using the First Step Act, not only to redirect what it is that we stand for as Americans and for our citizens, most of whom, by the way, 96% are returning at some point anyway. So instead of just warehousing, let's change our thinking and give these men and women opportunity to, again, really thrive and succeed in this Trump economy.
Brooke Rollins, thanks so much for being with us today on Washington Watch. She's the assistant to President Trump for Strategic Initiatives. And we've been talking about the First Step Act. Thanks so much for being with us. Even in Black History Month, I am reminded of the fact that over 90% of the individuals benefiting from retroactive sentencing reductions in the First Step Act are African Americans. So yet another thing this president is doing to enhance opportunities for all Americans. Well, coming up, you know that we talk a lot here about the pro-life movement, but two huge abortion-related bills are on the docket for the United States Senate. We'll have Vice President for Policy and Government here at FRC, Travis Weber, and FRC's Legislative Assistant, Connor Semmelsberger, to talk about these legislative developments and votes coming up next on Washington Watch.
In the U.S., the rate of chemical abortions is at an all-time high. This increase is being driven by the abortion industry, which wants abortion pills available through the pharmacy in the mail, making do-it-yourself abortions the future of the abortion industry. Abortion advocates once claimed that legal abortion would prevent back-alley abortions, but the health complications that often result from chemical abortion are eerily similar to those of back-alley abortions. For more information, visit frc.org/chemicalabortion.
China has become one of the most totalitarian states in human history. The Chinese Communist Party restricts religious practice and oppresses religious minorities on a sweeping scale, targeting those of every faith. the Chinese Communist Party's consistent abuses of human rights prove that it cannot be treated just like any other country. The United States must address these violations in their trade and diplomatic dealings with China. For more information about the human rights crisis in China, visit frc.org/China.
What are you reading this winter? Looking for timely and original commentary on human dignity, marriage, and religious liberty? We've got you covered at frcblog.com. The content on our blog is written by our policy experts, FRC staff, as well as outside contributors. Read about a wide variety of topics like crimes in the criminal state of China, how Game of Thrones mainstreamed sexual exploitation, transgender regret, the rise of the detransitioners, and many more. Stand for truth by staying informed at frcblog.com.
What other trip to Israel can you take that combines walking where Jesus walked with meeting today's Israeli leaders? This is Tony Perkins, President of Family Research Council, inviting you to spend an incredible 9 days in Israel with me, General Jerry Boykin, and former Congresswoman Michelle Bachmann from June the 2nd through the 12th. You'll discover the roots of your faith and learn from experts about the geopolitical landscape of the region. For more information, visit TonyPerkins.com or call 844-872-5155.
We all need to be lectured sometimes. Family Research Council's new podcast features selected talks by top thinkers from the archives of the FRC Speaker Series. Our podcast podium takes on tough issues like religious liberty, life, marriage, family, sexuality, public policy, and the culture, all from a biblical worldview. Listen with us to the lecture, then stick around afterward as we break down the content. The Lecture Me podcast is available wherever podcasts are found, or visit frc.org/podcasts.
Ever heard the term toxic masculinity? Hello, this is Tony Perkins, president of the Family Research Council. Some progressive universities are offering courses to help men unlearn rigid definitions of masculinity, treating it as if it were a mental health condition. Thankfully, the culture doesn't have the last word on manhood. God does. Check out our StandCourageous.com for an event in your area. That's StandCourageous.com.
Welcome back to Washington Watch. I'm Sarah Perry, sitting in for Tony Perkins on Thursday, the 20th of February. And we're headed toward two very big, very significant abortion-related votes in the United States Senate after many delays on the part of Democrats. The two votes up for the bill are going to protect the lives of the unborn, and they are going to provide for us, if passed, and we hope they will be, as we know that the U.S. Senate is controlled by Republicans who will hopefully vote not only for common sense legislation, but also along with their conscience about the reality of human life and when it begins. So we have two individuals here to talk about these bills. FRC's Vice President for Public Policy and Government Affairs, Travis Weber, who was often a guest on our show, and FRC's Legislative Assistant, Connor Semmelsberger. We are going to talk to them now, but before we do, I want to remind you all that FRC is leading a trip to Israel in June. For more information, go to TonyPerkins.com. Register there. If you've never gone to Israel, like I say very often, I have been three times. It is a life-changing event. It will supercharge your walk spiritually. It is not to be missed. Michelle Bachmann, Lieutenant General Jerry Boykin, Tony Perkins, all will be on the tour, in addition to many others who you get a chance to meet with, talk to individually. You'll also get a chance to meet with Israeli leaders in the national security and defense arena. So lots will be happening. For more information about our June trip, go to TonyPerkins.com. So, Connor, Travis, welcome back to Washington Watch.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for having us on.
Okay, so the two bills in the United States Senate after long delays. Travis, let me start with you. What are the two bills? And talk to me about some of the sort of boiled down parameters of these legislative initiatives.
Sure. So we're very excited to see votes in the U.S. Senate on the Born Alive Abortion Survivors Protection Act and the Pain-Capable Unborn Child Protection Act. The latter, the Pain-Capable bill, basically protects the unborn in the womb basically after the period of 20 weeks post-fertilization, at which point we know they can feel pain. The science is telling us that. If not earlier, they can feel pain by that point. So it's crucial that public policy protect these infants in the womb. The Born Alive Act, the Born Alive Bill, protects those babies who survive botched abortions, who are outside the womb, lying there on the table after being delivered, and yet we are still debating as a country whether we need to afford them the legal protection of medical care provided to any other such infant. This is atrocious that we're even debating this. So the Born Alive Bill is crucial that we pass it. And this bill would ensure that those infants, those babies, receive the same level of medical care that any other infant in that situation is afforded. I know Connor has more data than I do, though. So we're going to hope that he can fill in the gaps for us. And the strategy behind seeing these bills passed and any details that we need to provide, I know we're glad to have him with us, and he can provide that.
So. Now, before we go to Connor, you're talking about first the Pain Capable Act. And it's very interesting because in the House, Democrat Doug Jones was an individual approached by one of his constituents recently in a video circulating on Twitter that indicates precisely how some of these Senate Dems feel about the notion of what ought to be common sense provisions and protections for human life. Let's listen to that clip.
What stupid question have you got from
me? Do you think abortion should be banned after 5 months?
Sir, should abortion be banned? As I said, what a stupid...
You're voting on it next week, sir.
Yeah, and I'll vote on it next week.
So you hear him guffaw and call it a stupid question. So these are the Senate Democrats that we're up against. Do you have any inclination that they're going to be sufficiently sort of coalesced to push back on a Republican-controlled Senate and actually stonewall or defeat either one of these bills?
Well, I would hope that every elected official who is confronted with this choice would see the common sense need to protect these babies who survive botched abortions and these infants in the womb who feel pain. We provide anesthesia to women in comparable situations when they are undergoing medical procedures because we know these infants can feel pain. So why would we not protect them from the atrocious process which takes their life in the womb? But as far as the strategy and the dynamics behind the vote, I do want to pull in Connor on this to provide more. We are doing everything we can, though, providing resources on both these issues, and I believe they're going to be linked at the webpage for our listeners here. In addition to finding them at frc.org, we have resources at frc.org/bornalive and resources on fetal pain. Along with the dynamics of this issue at the state level that folks can see at our pro-life map, frc.org/pro-life map. So we have a lot on our website, and we're excited to talk about it. And I think Connor can help us fill in the gap on the strategy here.
Connor, tell us a little bit about some of the resources that we have at FRC and also sort of how we've directed our efforts approaching these two monumental votes.
Mm-hmm. I think it's good to start with how we even got to having these votes. And it really comes back to beginning of February, February 4th, the President's State of the Union address, he brought baby Ellie Schneider to the gallery there, who's born at just 21 weeks, one of the youngest babies ever born to survive in the United States. And he called on Congress to enact legislation like the Pain Capable Bill to ban late-term abortions.
That was so impactful to see that little girl.
It really was. And Senator McConnell has taken that call up and brought this bill to the floor. But even more so, again, just last week, the Senate Judiciary Committee had a hearing on the Born Alive bill. Our colleague Petrina Mosley did a wonderful job testifying to that, showing those stories, the statistics behind the fact that babies do, in fact, survive abortion. And so those two things leading up, we have two converging votes, two very important pieces of legislation before us next week at the behest of the president and Senate leaders. And so we've been doing our best to get our materials and resources ready to go so the constituents are up to speed and know exactly what's at stake and what's at play here, and to just show, like Travis has mentioned, the humanity of these children. And something I think that's really key with these votes is that it's really highlighting that there's two patients, something that abortionists time and time again fail to recognize, but yet the rest of the medical community, neonatologists, every other person in the medical community realizes there's two patients involved here, even when they're in the womb, again, providing anesthesia to infants in the womb when they're getting surgeries at 20 weeks and even earlier. So the first vote is going to come to the floor and say, hey, can we have the Senate agree that we should limit abortion at 20 weeks when infants can feel pain. And the voting record doesn't look good for the Democrats in the past. We hope and we encourage you guys to reach out to your senators to show that you support this legislation. But if you know, the past is a forewarning, what's to happen? The Democrats as a whole have rejected this type of legislation. And so if that happens again and we fail to reach the 60 votes necessary next week, then McConnell is going to directly go into the next vote, the Born Alive vote, which is now posing the next question to senators. Okay, if we can't agree that at 20 weeks when an infant we know can feel pain should not be gone through an excruciating abortion procedure, can we at least say that after they're born, they deserve that life-saving medical care? And this is going to be a question posed to all the U.S. senators, some key senators running for president, some of them, some key senators in swing states that are up for re-election this year. So it's really just going to be a hotbed of all these topics and issues we've been talking about for so long before the whole nation to see where do our top elected officials in the U.S. Senate stand on these issues.
You know, I would say ordinarily I've been flummoxed by the House Dems' opportunity, their intent, their ability to stonewall and to cease to actually bring to a vote this important legislation. Mm-hmm. But again, I think nothing in this political day and age surprises me at this point. So knowing what we're going into, give us the exact dates of the vote.
Yeah, so we don't know for sure. The Senate's going to arrive back into town Monday and do some nominations, votes to end up there. So likely we're looking at a Tuesday vote sometime, both of them right back to back. And this is also a good time to just reach out to your senators again, because there's going to be lots of time for senators to go to the floor and speak to this issue. We know what kind of talking points the Democrat Party already has prepared. We've heard them before in hearings. But I think it's a good opportunity for, you know, us out there to encourage our senators to really speak to the truth behind these issues, that we are caring about two patients here.
To add to that question, and really this is a question for both of you, is there anybody you think in the Senate right now who is sort of on the fence about how they're going to vote on these two pieces of legislation? Because I'd love to know those particular senators. Who are those that have mm-hmm. decided, well, I'm not entirely convinced. I'm just going to continue to sort of straddle the fence and see how the research, the pressure, the lobbying, how it plays out. Who's headed in that direction?
Well, for sure, like we heard, Senator Doug Jones down in Alabama, apparently he thinks it's laughable that we're even voting on these bills. But I'll remind you, he did vote for the Born Alive protections, but he voted against the pain cable protections last year. So somehow he's nuanced the difference between the two. But definitely Senator Jones down there in Alabama. But another senator that was even involved with part of why we had a Born Alive hearing was Senator Tim Kaine of Virginia. Again, he's not up for re-election. However, he called for a hearing, wanted to see more about the issue. And so we presented him all the data and facts and said, here's, this is what happens when infants survive abortion. So definitely him, and then his also counterpart, Mark Warner, who is running for re-election down in Virginia, another key target to say, hey, you know, we as Virginians, even though our state legislature isn't reflecting this, we as Virginians do believe, you know, common sense medical care for infants who survive abortion. And I think those are some key targets we're going to be looking at next week.
Target, Travis, what's your idea about what's going to work with those individuals? Do they need to hear more science, or is this strictly public pressure from constituents, voters, listeners? Is calling your senator to encourage them to vote the right way on these two pieces of legislation, is it enough in this instance, or do listeners need to do more?
I think it's all the above. Obviously, the more that they hear from their constituents is obviously helpful. They need to hear that the people who put them in office want these infants and these babies to be protected. They need to hear that en masse. They also need to understand the reality of this. And we saw this, we've seen this in advocacy on this issue. To be hearing from living, breathing people like you and I who've survived botched abortions.
Yeah.
Look at their lives. What are we going to say? We wish you weren't here. That's what they're saying by refusing to protect these babies who survived these abortions. And then to be confronted with the reality of these babies and the infants in the womb who feel pain. I mean, it's so cruel. Any other circumstance, we would not say, let them feel pain like that. Yet here we are because purely of the abortion lobby's pressure and influence. So every elected leader in America should be looking at these as no-brainer questions for a civilized society. We're encouraged that we have over 17,000 of our followers, listeners around the country who've already responded to our call to action yesterday to let their senators know that they should support the Pain Capable bill. We're going to be alerting our followers to respond and let their senators know they support the Born Alive bill tomorrow. We've been communicating our concerns and your concerns, our listeners' concerns, to the Hill, which is what we're doing every day here with Connor and our other members of the team. Letting members know this is an important issue to you. Here's how you what you need to know about it. Here's how to talk about it. There's a lot of issues competing for public attention. These issues are crucial, and we've been sure to remain diligent in communicating our listeners and concerns to members on the Hill. So we're hoping for a good result with this vote. We'll have to wait and see.
Connor, you talked a little bit earlier about the fact that we know the science indicates, the data indicates that there are instances of these babies born alive who do survive attempted abortions. Our Washington update, available on our homepage, was just about Sophia Khan overseas in England, who went in for what she was told was 100% effective saline abortion. The child, she felt wriggling around, and the infant was born crying, which for her was traumatic. And yet I'm thinking of the medical and the hospital staff who are indicating to her it's 100% effective. Your baby has spina bifida. This is the right thing to do. And then to experience this firsthand, if that doesn't break your heart, there is nothing else that will. So Democratic Party right now is sort of in a course corrective pendulum swing against Donald Trump. We know that pro-life and religious liberty issues are really at the top of mind of most center-right voters, pro-life being perhaps the ultimate issue that sort of mobilizes the base cohesively, regardless of theological belief system or church affiliation. So did the Democrats last night, in your estimation, did they shoot themselves in the foot, or have they continued to do so based on the fact that they trend further and further left on an issue so important to Republican voters?
Most definitely they have. I mean, next week, these votes are going to be so key. Senator Bernie Sanders, Senator Elizabeth Warren are going to have to go down to the Senate floor and vote, you know, if they back what they're saying on the campaign trail, they're going to vote against both of these measures. They're going to look people like Melissa Odin in the eye and say, you don't exist. They're going to look, you know, baby Ellie, who was, again, in the Senate, you know, gallery there, or the House gallery there, saying, you don't matter to us. And that's what we see in this National Democratic Party. And it's sad, you know, the sorting of the parties where there are no longer pro-life allies in the Democrat Party, at least in the national stage, that we can rely on to vote for life. You know, seeing tough contested races there. But on the national level, they have just strayed so far away from what we know through polling, continuous years of polling. Most recently this year, 70% of Americans saying that they would like to restrict abortion to only the first 3 months of pregnancy. I think that's something so key to just show the American people are so the Democrat Party is so out of step with the American people. And that's going to be on display next week in the Senate.
We talked a little bit earlier this week about the fact that recent op-eds are saying, listen, you got to hold your nose. You got to vote Democratic, even if you're pro-life. Just you have to educate and you can't advocate. What's your perspective on that, Travis? Is that the case?
Sarah, I would say it's the opposite. If you're pro-life, you got to vote Republican. We know President Trump has called for both these bills to be passed. He'll sign them into law. That's what's driving a lot of pro-life voters into the arms of Republicans, who they might disagree with on a host of other things. We want to celebrate life wherever we can, and right now, Republicans are carrying the ball in this.
Travis Weber and Connor Semmelsberger have been my guests today. Two important votes coming up. Call your senator. Encourage them to vote the right way. Go to FRC.org and go to TonyPerkins.com. We'll be linked there to important resources that will help you understand the issues and encourage your senators the right way. We'll see you tomorrow on Washington Watch.
Washington Watch with Tony Perkins is brought to you by Family Research Council and is entirely listener-supported. Portions of the show discussing candidates are brought to you by Family Research Council Action. For more information on anything you've heard today, or to find out how you can partner with us in our ongoing efforts to promote faith, family, and freedom, visit TonyPerkins.com. Also, to leave a comment about Washington Watch, call our watch line at 1-866-372-7234. That's 1-866-372-7234.